It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own terrific website, which is themediabeat.us. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and he's been traveling the past several weeks, so we missed him last week because he was in a place where he couldn't file a report. But this week, we say bonjour, Mr. Tarachuk.
Yes, hello. I'm glad to be joining Marshall Miles in his diligent questioning as ever, but still not from the media capital of the world, New York City, since I continue to be on the road overseas. I'm in fact reporting in from France this week. Bonjour to you too, Marshall. It's a European country that, unlike some others, is now settling into some form of regular life after its hard-fought, but in the end, decisive presidential elections just last month. So, yeah, war in Europe. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, of course, inevitably dominates the news agenda here in Europe. But it's telling, I think, that the French media have this week been foregrounding a news development that's of literally universal impact, affecting every single individual on the planet, we can say. I mean, obviously enough, the United Nations report this week from its World Meteorological Organization confirming yet again, I'm afraid, that global warming continues inexorably along its perilous path. There's lots of confirmatory detail in the WMO report, of course, but to be brief, it sounds the alarm, and yet again, we do have to keep sounding the alarm on average global temperatures increasing, hothouse gas emissions still rising, sea levels rising, and the temperature of the oceans themselves also reaching now record levels. I have to reflect that there's a doom-laden French proverb, plus ça change, about things remaining horribly the same, even as we stare disaster in the face now. But let's talk about domestic news here in France. President Emmanuel Macron, now that he's fought off the election threat from the hard right, it's not exaggerated to call it the fascist neo-Nazi far right, I should say, he's now named his prime minister, a woman, Elizabeth Borne. She's not the first female prime minister of France since the socialist president François Mitterrand appointed Edith Cresson way back in 1991. But there's a difference. It's being emphasized in this country's very gender-conscious language. Prime Minister Borne is being called in French La Première Ministre Cresson. Borne, rather. That's La Première Ministre in the feminine form for Elizabeth Borne. But for Edith Cresson, back in the benighted 90s, she had to put up with being le premier ministre, with all the strange contradiction involved between her human and her linguistic gender, or genders, I should perhaps say. But the other more serious and kind of big difference between the two women is that Borne has been put in charge of all matters of environmental planning, as well as being a day-to-day head of the government overall. It could just be symbolic, perhaps, but it's meant, I think, well, no, it's generally recognized as and intended to be a reflection of how seriously Macron and France as a whole, really, is now having to take the threat represented by climate change. About Madame Borne herself, France's leading newspaper, Le Monde, said yesterday that she's going to be Macron's Swiss Army knife, an all-purpose pragmatic politician who gets things done. We shall see you one week.
Interesting. Following what goes on, when you take a look at the European Union, the country that I think doesn't fit the mold like most other countries is France. I don't know why. I've just always had that feeling that...
Well, it's always had its own individualistic streak, I have to say. But in the current situation, you might say that Macron and Elizabeth Borne might have it easier than some world leaders, even within Europe. France's inflation rate, for example, is only about half of the United States and the UK's cost of living numbers. It's 4.5% inflation on an annual basis for the French, compared with about 8% for the English speakers, a bit above 8 for America, or just a tad below 8 for the Brits. And that, in Britain, it's the worst they've known since the days of Margaret Thatcher 40 years ago. France's success here is largely because of foresight and, interestingly here for American audiences, I suspect, direct government intervention by Macron. And he ordered a limit on energy price increases last year. And as we all know, energy and fuel prices feed into the price of everything else very significantly, especially if those other things we buy have to travel any distance to get to the customer, of course. France's low inflation rate, by the way, is not at the expense of economic growth, broadly speaking. The country is now back to above pre-pandemic levels of growth. And by contrast, Britain, where I was just last week, Britain hit, as it has been by both COVID and Brexit, of course, is still languishing a percentage point or so below total recovery. But continuing with France a minute, I'd say that the most immediate and newsy development that this second Macron administration has to deal with has, of course, been Ukraine. We can't ever get away from the Ukraine war, of course, and nor should we. Macron's previously energetic efforts to broker peace there are now said to have been dealt their final death blow, as Vladimir Putin this week ordered the expulsion of French diplomats from Moscow, cutting off diplomatic relations, in effect. Like these expulsions often do, these involve some tit-for-tat action. France, Spain, and Italy as well all expelled Russians ahead of this Russian move. And as far as France is concerned, France has impounded a villa owned by Putin's son-in-law. And France is also pursuing investigations of war crimes allegedly committed by Russian soldiers against French nationals who have been killed in Ukraine. Now, all of this hasn't meant that France is seen as siding with Ukraine wholeheartedly. Ukrainian media sources are now suggesting there's, in fact, a cooling of relations between the two countries, France and Ukraine. Macron used to speak, you'll remember, with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky on a daily basis, as well as talking to Putin, of course. But he hasn't been on the phone with Zelensky now for 4 days. Ukrainians evidently suspect the French of favoring the idea of Ukraine giving up some of its eastern territory to the Russians, and that's, of course, not a popular notion in Kyiv by any means. And according to French commentators, the French government itself could simply be practicing the old ancient art of realpolitik, good old pragmatic reality-facing politics. They seem to think that the only way to resolve this war is to have both sides make some concessions. Well, there again, we will have to see how that goes.
You know, you look at Ukraine and you look at the situation there. We'll get back to that in just a second. But now that you're in France and you've any reaction to once again what the rest of the world doesn't have quite as bad as we do, and that this is the shooting that took place in Buffalo at the supermarket. Once again, the international reaction that you see over there.
Well, yes, looking back on the U.S., I should report that Europe cannot help collectively shaking their heads in sheer incomprehension. Yet again, of course, when we hear that ring of plus échange again, when it comes to yet another mass murder in the States, this time in Buffalo, upstate New York, only last Saturday, Europeans shake their heads in just about every media outlet I've been looking at here about the shooter's age, 18, his ability to legally obtain his weapon and illegally modify it, making it extra deadly, the brainwashing of an adolescent with race hatred ideology, and his announcing and discussing of his planned atrocity ahead of time in an internet chat room. Most of all, perhaps, though, heads are being shaken again, yet again, as I say, about the United States Constitution's enshrined right to bear arms and the relevant amendment being employed now, as so often, to permit or even perhaps even to excuse the unending continuance of such mass shootings, now running as they are, and the French are very acutely stressing this in their reporting this week, mass shootings running at 10 per week, 10 per week, across the whole breadth of the land of the free and the home of the brave. The Europeans are saddened and remain puzzled about all this.
You know, and I think when Europeans and the rest of the world look at the United States, abortion is an issue that that is across the world. I mean, there are countries, there are cities, there are towns, there are nations that don't allow abortion and look on it very, very strongly. In America, we've had Roe versus Wade for over 50 years, but I think what America seems to do with these things, David, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you don't see in Europe is overreaction. And by overreaction, I mean the Roe versus Wade potential decision, which will strip Roe versus Wade. Oklahoma has now passed a law. This is actually a law they have passed that say they have banned abortions after conception, two people, married, not married, whatever, have sex, and from that point on, a fetus is considered alive, and it's banned at conception. This is something that, and you know, we have 50 states, we have 50 different sets of governments that can apply their own laws, but people in Europe must look at this and just shake their heads as how can something so different than a law that's been in effect in our country for 50 years happen like this?
Yes, well, Europeans again look and somewhat shake their head in a degree of mystification here. This is a terrible generalization, and of course there are many exceptions along the way, but the Europeans in general think of this as social issue as being a settled matter, a sense of socially accepted behavior changing over the centuries. And, in the 20th century, bringing us around to legally accepted ways of conducting abortion in certain, properly controlled and fully recognized circumstances. It's a puzzlement again to Europeans to find that America is now taking a body of law, legal at the highest level of the courts of the country's judicial system, the famous Roe v. Wade judgment from the early 1970s, but taking something that has been, in that phrase, settled law, somewhat contended phrase now, it's been settled law for 50 years, and putting it in reverse for what looks like half of the country when things are tossed to individual state laws as they would be by a reversal of the federal law by the new right-wing dominated Supreme Court justices, certainly here in France, there's a kind of astonishment about this when Europe has taken pretty much the same steps overall, a little ahead of time, perhaps. When Britain was still in Europe, I should add as a sort of sub-comment here, but Britain was perhaps early in this reformation of law, a little behind the Scandinavians in Northern Europe, but still ahead of the rest of the main body of Europe, back in the 1960s, legalizing abortion at the instigation of a member of parliament who came from my old Scottish borderland district. And that became law of the land, and then other parts of Europe followed suit. And we now have what we have. And it ends up with an ironic point that French media have been making quite a thing of this week, that we can now foresee a situation in which American women would have to fly to Europe to get an abortion legally, depending on, of course, which state they lived in and how difficult it was for them to get to states that would still allow it. And that contains an extraordinary irony for Europe, especially since the country in Europe that I've been in most of the last couple of months, i.e. Ireland, a country which, you know, like some of the countries around the rest of the world, would still do hold on to restrictive rules against abortion, that country being Ireland, dominated by the Catholic Church for so many decades, even Ireland had a referendum, a national referendum, and the people's will was so clearly expressed that abortion should be legalized, and it has been, in line with the rest of Europe. Ireland is possibly one of the most European members of the European Union. So now you have the really ironic situation of a complete turnaround of what is regarded as the progress of history, in that Americans can now be seen, American women can now be, could in future soon be seen, traveling to, of all places, Ireland to get an abortion. What a turnaround of historical developments that is.
And I want to make this clear. I am not assailing people who are against abortions, not at all. What amazes me in this country is there just can't be opposition and search for common ground. There has to be laws that are passed by entire legislatures that are absurd. And it's not only on abortion; it's on everything else. In the meantime, we can get back and take a look at what's going on with NATO. Now, two countries have applied. Turkey, of course, is against one country. I think Turkey's just looking for some leverage with the United States and other countries to get something out of this deal. Do you agree with that or not?
Well, the view in Europe is that, given what's happened, it's hardly surprising that both Sweden, long neutral, and Finland, long under the imminent, or at least very close, proximate, you might say, threat of Russia, certainly in the Soviet Union days, regarded as a constant threat against Finland. But Finland and Sweden wanting to come into NATO has upset the Turks, or at least the Turkish president, Erdogan. And you say, of course, he's opposing it. Well, he's been opposing it, but he's been flip-flopping too. The European, mainstream European commentary, at least, he's been regarded as something of a flip-flopper, because he first of all said he objected to these two countries joining NATO, and of course he has every right to do that as a head of state of one already existing NATO country. But then he changed his mind and said he's not going to oppose it, and guess what? He's changed his mind yet again. And now he is opposing it for the reasons that you rightly identify, most likely, that he can get something out of it by putting his objection on the table. One of the things he certainly would like to get, and that's been very clear since his involvement, it is very much his administration's involvement. A different Turkish leadership might have done things differently, but very direct intervention in Syria in order to protect right-wing tendency in Turkey would regard as Turkey's national interests being threatened by civil war in Syria and entering the war in the way that it has, that triggered anti-Turkish reaction in Europe, and not least of all in Sweden, a country that takes the idea of human rights very seriously. And they, in turn, set sanctions against Turkey. So one of the things that early on, certainly once in being difficult over Finland and Sweden's possible entry into NATO, is the fact that out of this tussle right now, he may get an easing of those sanctions against his own country.
All right, and the news story that's been under the radar here, and China, of course, has been all over the world trying to establish their dominance in lots of different ways. And finally, the United States has paid attention to that, and Joe Biden has taken a trip to try to, I won't say blunt, Asia falling in under the realm of China. Is this a fairly
certainly
big...
Certainly to rally Asian support to the American side in this argument, absolutely. That is one of his jobs. It has to be recognized.
You know, and this is, to me, this is a big story because, I know there's a lot of Americans that think America first and they want to pull back and just deal with America. But unfortunately now in the world we live in, America can't just be America. America has got to regain its place in the world as a leader, and even for all our faults of what we do, as a bastion of good and somebody that is actually a good neighbor and a good ally.
Good ally, that's the important key word. The Biden administration, we're at the point of midterms now, but it's still trying to find its feet in reaction to what went before. 4 years of Trumpism took the United States in a wholly different direction, retreating from its place in the world, a kind of isolationism, which the rest of the world is very disturbed by. I generalize, but I mean, I guess China would be pretty happy about America retreating into itself, but much of the rest of the world is not. And you might say internationally minded Americans welcome this change too. Biden has been greeted with many cries of "Oh, at last, America is back." Not just for Americans concerned about international developments, but international leaders right across the globe saying it's good that America's taking up its proper role as the rich, for now at least, the richest nation in the world, with a certain responsibility that leadership brings. And this trip to Asia is, in a sense, an attempt to go back. But in a positive sense, go back to those Obama years when there was a definite attempt constantly made to set the world, the American eyes on the world in an Asian direction. And that things happened to divert that overall push, of course, and it's now been definitely scuppered for 4 years and longer, perhaps you could say, by the Trump years. And now Biden's responsibility is to reassert it now, just as his president, to whom he was vice president, tried so hard those years ago.
It's an interesting time. That's all we've got to say. What's going on I think that to Americans that are afraid that America getting involved in the world once again means we're going to get involved in wars. I beg for people to look at what Joe Biden has done, what even George Bush did during the original crisis that cropped up in the Middle East with Desert Storm. Was when America's strong on the international stage, we can put together 70, 80 countries to back something when we think that a wrong has to be righted. And that's the America that the world wants to see.
Yes, it almost has a nostalgia ring to it now, too, that phrase, the coalition of the willing. It's not brute force doing it. It's an argument. An argument goes on, and you case an argument for taking an international action, and if your argument has strength, then you will gather strong allies around you to support it. And that's what's been done in the past, not always to great effect and not always to good effect in the long run. To do it with good intent and to do it with well-argued diplomacy and with, you know, in the end, the support of many other countries, demonstrating that, in fact, there is a kind of global intention here. That's a better way than just pulling out of international contention because you think it's not your role and that you've got to put your own country's interests first in a purely selfish manner. We're seeing an attempt to do it now, and I suspect that with the Ukraine invasion by Russia making everyone think a lot more seriously about the state of play internationally, I think we're going to find a lot more conscious effort to develop alliances and develop concerted forms of international action.
Are you back in the States next week or still traveling in Europe?
I will be reporting back again next week from France still, but thereafter, I hope, though you never know in these days, I think the United States will be my base thereafter.
I just think it's great when you're traveling throughout Europe because you really can get a sense of what the rest of the world is thinking about different events that we're involved in and the rest of the world, what they're thinking about the United States being involved. It gives us a great different look, an expert from afar look, and we appreciate it, David. We'll speak to you next week.
I look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat live this morning from France. You can find the Media Beat on Robinhood Radio at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. One more week in France, and then he's back in the good old United States of America.